I'm Brandon Bartnick, and this is the Future of Mobility Podcast.
The Future of Mobility Podcast is focused on the pursuit of safe, sustainable, effective, and accessible transportation of goods and people. Given the critical nature of the world's climate and energy needs, these topics have never been more important, and they're certainly important to me. So, this podcast is a weekly interview series in which I learn from and put the spotlight on the people helping to develop and implement the technology required to move us forward. Who am I? As mentioned, my name is Brandon Bartnick, and I'm an engineer who realized that making a positive impact is the most important thing to me, both through this podcast and my career in the industry. If you're passionate about any of the topics I cover here, please feel free to reach out on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to connect. Also, if you hear anything you like, please consider sharing the Future Mobility with a friend or colleague. This podcast is brought to you by Edison Manufacturing and Engineering. Technology innovation is great, but it doesn't mean anything if we can't bring our impactful products to life, which means we have to build them. And unfortunately, that's easier said than done, especially for startups and evolving companies that need a reliable option for low-volume builds. That's where we come in. Edison is your turnkey manufacturing partner, specializing in build and assembly of highly complex products in annual volumes of 10 to tens of thousands, utilizing an agile and capital-light approach. If you need a trusted manufacturing partner, then please visit us at edison-mfg.com or feel free to reach out to me directly at brandon.bartnick@edison-mfg.com or by visiting my LinkedIn page, Brandon Bartnick. Now to this week's episode. Special episode here today. This is called a podcast swap that I'm doing with a friend of the show, Paul Comfort. So Paul's a three-time guest, rare air here in the Future Mobility Podcast. Go back and listen to some of those if you haven't yet. And what we're doing here, he has his own podcast, Transit Unplugged, that I'm giving a little gift here, and you're giving you the opportunity to listen to one of his recent episodes, get a sneak peek in that. So Paul, would you mind sharing a bit about that work that you're doing and what you cover with Transit Unplugged?
Sure. Great to be with you again on the show, Brandon. So Transit Unplugged, I started it 6.5 years ago. I had left after 30 years the transit industry as CEO of the MTA in Baltimore. And my company, Trapeze at the time, asked me, would you like to start a podcast? And I was like, yeah, I know exactly what I wanted because I had done talk radio for 16 years. I want to do a podcast where I interview CEOs of transit systems. And we talk about the good stuff happening in transit. You know, there's enough in the news, usually, you know, whenever a CEO gets on the news of a transit system, it's because there's been a derailment or a strike or something like that. They don't get a chance to really, you know, shine. And so I wanted to give them a chance to shine. That's basically what we still do. We showcase what I think are some of the top public transit executives around the world. And we talk about the latest trends in public transit, whether they're technology, which ties in with my company now, Medaxo, or even if it's non-technology things, just you know, how to grow your career in public transportation. That's something we're focused on a lot lately. I ask, like I just did an interview with the CEO of a major transit system, and I asked her to walk me through her entire career, lessons she learned, you know, and that kind of stuff, so that for people that are like in staff and transit agencies who want to move up, gives them examples that they might think about, options to move up the ladder in a transit agency.
Yeah, great. And one of the reasons I enjoy talking with you so much and enjoy your show is I think it's a necessary complement to the topics that I tend to cover here in the Future Mobility. So I'm focused a lot on the vehicle technology and how companies are built around that technology to bring it to market. You then take kind of the other perspective, right, of the transit agencies and public transportation. And one of my core beliefs is that like those two have to come together and do well if we're actually going to make the overall impact that we're trying to do in the transportation ecosystem. So I love getting your thoughts and talking about kind of the implementation and listening to the implementation work there and how this ecosystem works.
Yep. Now, can I tell you though, there's one thing about you that I'm jealous of, and I don't get jealous very often. And that is your great hair. You still got that young man's great hair, man.
Yeah, so I guess it's time stamp in early 2024. We'll see. Hopefully, you're listening to this later in the future. So there's still hair on the head. But cool. So Paul, the episode we're highlighting here with a great guest you had recently, Adam Hill. Could you speak a bit about Adam as well as the discussion here?
Yeah, I think your listeners will really love Adam Hill. First off, everybody loves hearing from somebody with a British accent. But Adam Hill is the editor-in-chief of ITS International Magazine, Intelligent Transport Systems, you know, and they are a global organization that publishes magazines and website stuff and thought leadership and puts on conferences. As a matter of fact, they have a conference coming up in April in Phoenix, ITS America. But what we dove into, Brandon, on this podcast is we started off talking about high-speed rail, which is obviously a very hot topic in the United Kingdom and here in the U.S. And we both kind of lament how that neither country is going as fast as we want them to. You know, we're starting to pick up here a little bit in the U.S., but even that is not true high-speed rail, like maglev that's going to go 300 miles per hour, like the one I rode in China maybe 10 years ago from Shanghai to Beijing. But it's higher speed, so that's good news. So we talk about that, and then he digs into congestion pricing, which, of course, is hot news in America with New York City moving forward with it, and they've had it for a while in London. And then we talk about their new ultra-low emission zone, which ULEZ, you may have heard it called, and trying to implement that and how that's created a kind of a blowback, you know, a brush fires in politics there. And the politicians have taken notice. And you may have even seen the prime minister has changed some positions over the last few months to become less what they might call anti-car. And so he talks about all that. Very interesting dive into the political side, as well as kind of the practical side of implementing it. So, and then we close out with talking about how to make public transportation capture the public interest. So it's a great conversation from one of our top thinkers in the industry.
Great. Yeah. And I certainly recommend, if you like what I cover on the Future Mobility Podcast, check out this enjoy this episode. And if you like this, check out Transit Unplugged, make it part of your regular podcast routine. And Paul, can you share when how often do these episodes come out, and where can people get them?
Yeah, so we have two options for your listeners, and they're all free. Podcasts are basically like a 30-minute podcast interview I do every week. It drops on Wednesdays, and then once a month, we have a TV show that complements it, where I visit a different city around the world and we dive into their food, their culture, and their transit. So it's kind of like Anthony Bourdain meets Brandon Bartnick, you know, and we do the, you know, we cover what's behind the scenes in their public transit system. We interview their top executives, but show you what's going on. And then we dive into the food and culture of that region. So that's on YouTube on our channel, Transit Unplugged TV. It's a 15-minute show once a month.
Great. Well, yeah. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate this. Enjoy, if you're listening, enjoy this episode. Check out Transit Unplugged. And yeah, thanks. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, buddy. Welcome to Transit Unplugged, now in our seventh season. I'm your host and producer, Paul Comfort. Today, I'm talking with Adam Hill, editor-in-chief of London-based ITS International Magazine. Adam and I discuss how great high-speed rail is, and we compare notes on why it's so difficult to build, both there in England and here in the U.S., A big challenge in public transit worldwide is getting people out of their personal cars and onto trains and buses. Adam and I talk about that and how tools like congestion charging and low emission zones can help or hinder that. Adam talks about how London's new ultra low emission zone, or ULEZ, is supposed to encourage taking transit, but there are a myriad of challenges to implementing it, including some political. It's a great lesson for us here in America and beyond in encouraging people to change their commuting habits. Join us for this fascinating discussion with one of the world's leading transportation experts, Adam Hill. And make sure you stay tuned for Mike's Minute after my interview with Adam.
Yeah.
Very good. You're at your nation's capital, and I'm near ours, near here in Washington, D.C. Adam, great to have you on the podcast, my friend.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great honor.
Well, you're welcome. You are a self-described transit nerd and, of course, editor of ITS International Magazine. Tell me about a little bit about your organization and yourself.
Sure. Well, ITS International is the leading platform for advanced technology for traffic management and urban mobility. We have print and digital products. So the print magazine comes out 6 times a year. We have digital platforms, social media, and so on. Something like 20,000 readers, and we have a fortnightly e-newsletter, which goes to 38,000 transport professionals. And around half our, we're based in the UK, but half our readership is in North America.
And for those of us in North America, what's a fortnight?
I'm so sorry. It's every 2 weeks.
That's all good. I think a lot of people know that, but it's actually not very common. Austin, Texas. And guess who I ran into?
Tell me.
Andy Byford.
Fantastic.
Former Commissioner of Transportation. He was there at a conference I was speaking at. He and I were both speaking, and we got together afterward for drinks. And I'm very excited about the work he's doing and a topic that you and I are going to talk about, which is bringing high-speed rail to the United States. It seems like Europe and Asia have figured it out, but we're still, you know, trying to get there?
Well, it's kind of you to say that Europe's figuring it out, because in the UK at the moment, we are struggling a little with high-speed rail. There's a major project, HS2, which has hit the buffers. Is that perhaps fair to say? It was originally designed to run from London to Birmingham, which is about 120 miles north, something like that, then to run on to two other great northern cities, Manchester and Leeds. Well, the northern bit, the bit after Birmingham, has really run into difficulty. And in fact, the Prime Minister this afternoon is in Manchester, UK.
With Mayor Andy?
Oh, yes, with Mayor Andy. And he's talking about whether he won't be drawn on whether or not the high-speed 2 line will eventually go to Manchester. And I guess if you're actually in Manchester, you probably don't want to give any bad news to people there today. But we'll see.
Yeah, I just read that. That's very interesting. It's billions of dollars they've already spent on it and getting it planned. Is that right? And engineering?
That's absolutely right. And I mean, it's an extraordinary infrastructure project. I mean, it's very ambitious, but I think there's quite a lot of consensus here that it would have made more sense to have started the work in the north of England, where connectivity between cities and towns is perhaps not as good as it is within the southeast of England and around London, which is very well served. And the London to Birmingham route, for example, that's very quick already. That's a very, very convenient line. So the idea of making that quicker didn't necessarily make that much sense. But northern connectivity does make sense in England. And yet, that is the bit that has been gradually sacrificed, cut back bit by bit over the last few years. And there may be further cuts to it as well. Not only that, Paul, the line, when it does come to London at the moment, is not going to go to the centre of London. It's going to go to a place called Old Oak Common, which is on the outskirts of London. Now, I've lived in London 30 years. I've never heard of Old Oak Common. Neither has anyone else. And it's just, you do wonder sometimes, these great high-speed rail is a fantastic means of creating connectivity, economic growth, et cetera, et cetera. We all get that. But you do have to get it right. And I think what's happening with HS2 at the moment in the UK, well, in England, I should say, yeah, rather than the UK, shows that these big ticket, multi-billion dollar projects, they are hard, really hard to get right. Although I have to say, I think we're making a spectacular meal of it. There's difficult and then there's really difficult. So it's, but yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm fascinated by the idea of high-speed rail in the US as well. 20 odd years ago, I took a train from LA to San Francisco. Although, of course, it didn't take a train from LA to San Francisco because it doesn't go to San Francisco. You may be able to help me sort of with where it stops, but it stops near San Francisco. And then I had to get someone to pick me up, get a ride. You know, America just seems to me to be absolutely crying out for high-speed rail. It would be the most fantastic innovation. And great that you've got the transit daddy there to sort of help you out.
Train daddy's here. It's funny, the story you told about that project in England reminds me of what's happening here in the U.S. You're probably aware, but the effort that is furthest along is the California High-Speed Rail Project. Yeah, so in California, like you said in England, it's very interesting. Another long-term high-speed rail project that has been whittled back little by little so that it's kind of going what critics would say are from, you know, somewhere no one really wants to go to or come from, to the same on the other end. I mean, there are cities, there are people there, but they're not like LA, San Francisco, big places like that, big trip generators. Unlike what's happening in Florida here, where a private company is moving ahead, and it's not high speed in a traditional sense, it's not over 200 miles per hour, but it's higher speed. And this is a company called Brightline Trains. And they have had a train going from Miami to West Palm Beach, and they just recently opened up a station in Orlando at the airport, great location. So that you can connect between the two. And it's this intercity transportation, Adam, that is where you've got distances that are too short to really fly, but too long to drive, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So anyway, very interesting. And now they're trying to start one between LA and Las Vegas, which would be a great trip generator because a lot of people go that way and they have to fly now. It's too far. It's, you know, it's just over, I think I did it a few years ago. I think it's like 3.5, 4 hours if you're going very fast, which I was.
But it's so interesting because I was in Detroit just a few years ago, and when that beautiful mainline station there was still a little bit in rack and ruin, and now having seen the pictures, it's stunning, the redevelopment that's gone on around that area. But again, I was walking around just thinking, I can't believe that this extraordinary sort of cathedral to public transport, as was, is no longer useful. And so I get, things change, but some things do stay the same. And rail links are such a fantastic, it's a fantastic way to travel. It really is just one of the great ways to get around. But B, it's efficient. It can be cost effective. It can be time effective. And I just wonder why there isn't maybe the passion, where that's gone. And again, I understand the development of the automobile and the development of relatively cheap flights. Can it come back? You know the market backwards, Paul. Will we get to a point where high-speed rail in the US is something that is passionately championed by policymakers, et cetera?
So it's a lot of it's political, right? Because the politicians are the ones that appropriate the funds. And when you have a pendulum in politics in America, where we go from Republican to Democrat parties back and forth, there's sometimes less enthusiasm, or depending on where it's at, there's less enthusiasm sometimes and it stalls. But also, that's not the only issue, Adam. When I was CEO of the MTA in Baltimore, when I got there in 2015, there was a study underway to look at high-speed rail between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. And they said, we can get this down to a 15-minute trip, which is very exciting for people because a lot of people make that trip every day, tens of thousands of people. They drive their cars, and it takes an hour to 2 hours, depending on traffic. If you could get that down to 15 minutes, you'd have a built-in ridership. So they were studying it when I got there. We got, I think, a $20-some million grant from the federal government. We were looking at Japanese maglev technology. Our governor and my boss, the Secretary of Transportation, actually went to Japan to take a look at it up close and personal, and they came back very enthused about it. So we're in the end of 2023 now. Guess what's happening with it? They're still studying it. So I know there's a lot of things that have to be looked at, but gee whiz, can't we do this a little faster?
See, I've never been to laugh or cry because it is extraordinary. I mean, we've had some success recently in the southeast of England with a thing called, it was called Crossrail. It's been reborn as the Elizabeth Line.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
I know you've been on it. I know a lot of people have done some great travelogues and so on from there. And it's a fantastic line. It runs from east of London to west of London through the centre, stopping at mainly a lot of new stations, but incorporating some of the old underground tube stations and so on that were there. And it's extraordinary. Getting on it the first time, it really was like running after walking. It was just a wonderful experience. And it still is. I mean, a year on, my enthusiasm is undimmed. But one thing about something like that, and the reason the Elizabeth Line works so well as a user, as a consumer, as a rider, is its frequency. It not only takes you places you want to go, but it does it at very regular intervals. It's rare that you're waiting more than 10 minutes to get a train. Now, what happened? My commute to the office, I live in North London, but I come to our office, which a couple of times a week, which is where I am now, which is sort of to the southeast of London, going right round. The Elizabeth Line stops about three stops away from my office. The problem then is I've got to change to just to go 10 minutes on another line, but it doesn't run very frequently. I can't time it right leaving from home. So it's just not worth using in many ways because the connection just isn't there. For various reasons, when I leave the office to go home, I can time it. It's fine. So it works very well. But it was just one of those little indications of how it's wonderful to have these new infrastructure projects. And I'm really not complaining. I sound like, as we would say in England, a whinger. I'm not complaining. But it's sometimes if things don't quite match up, it can be frustrating. Yeah. And very frustrating for users, I think. We're passionate advocates of getting people onto public transport. But I do understand sometimes if you're not so passionate and your car is a very convenient option, as it is for so many people, everywhere in the world. Yeah, you do need a bit more persuasion to get on, and you need it to be as simple as possible for everything, from the connectivity, the frequency, also the payments. Of course, you know, that has to be simple too. So I've got sympathy with people who are more reluctant public transport users. Oh, we've just got to bring them on board. We've just got to keep spreading the word. I'm talking too much, but can I just say, the way that you bring in, I really like the way that you have brought in travelogue and cuisine into your talking about public transit. I think it's It's a great way of just drawing people in and maybe getting people who didn't know they were interested in public transit interested. Because who wouldn't be? You've got Paella or, some great shots of Lisbon, wherever you are. But that's the thing. It's getting people interested in something that, is when it's done right, mass transit is just this extraordinary way of moving people around great distances or even quite small distances, but very effectively, very efficiently. It's frustrating. And I do understand people's frustration when it's their experiences not as good as it should be.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And thank you for that compliment for our TV show, Transit Unplugged TV, where each month we go to a different city and we dive into their public transportation, but we also show you fun places you can go riding the public transportation. Again, the idea is to kind of expand upon the nuts and bolts of what it takes to run a transit system, like you talked about, the frequency, maybe the technology, and the headways, et cetera, and to say, hey, you know what? Like I just did in Austin, Texas. So I was there with Dottie, who is the CEO of the transit system, Dottie Watkins, and we're at their main major bus hub. And we filmed me saying to her, hey, I've heard about this place, Barton Springs, which is a big tourist attraction. People go and swim there. It's cold water. It comes out of a spring. It's like 68 degrees. I wanted to jump in during the show, but we didn't have time. We were scheduled for another event right after. But so we say, well, and I say to her, as we do on every episode, but how do I get there? And then she'll say, how to get there is you get on the line 30, which comes right from here every 15 minutes, and it'll take you directly and drop you off right in front of Barton Springs. So the thought is, you know, just what you said, showing the fun part, the food, the music, the culture, and all of them are accessible. And without mobility, so many people would not have access to all of that. But for those that do, and our taxpayers, we need to show them the fun side. They may not ride public transit. They may say, I don't want to spend my taxpayer subsidy dollars to subsidize people. They should charge them full freight. Well, you know what? It also helps these businesses stay alive because it brings people to them. It provides employees. So for instance, you know, when I used to run the light rail system in Baltimore, one of the lines goes right to the airport and it's not just for passengers. Ricky, who is the CEO there, said, Paul, you know, you're bringing in most of our employees ride the light rail from Baltimore out to. So there's a lot to public transportation that the casual observer may not see, right?
No, absolutely. But I think it's interesting. The fun stuff is great. And actually, I really like that idea of showing people where they can go on public transit. But in the main, people aren't necessarily going to fun places. They're going to work. They're going to school, wherever. And getting people out of their cars and onto mass transit. I mean, it's such a difficult play, I think, particularly in many parts of the States and certainly in many parts of the UK. There's, you know, I live in London, so public transport is fantastic. You know, you can get by without a car or driving relatively infrequently. You go much further out, it's more difficult. So I think as well, we, and by which actually I mean me, have to beware against, simply because we have such a great experience with public transport, to realize that for other people, it's more of a hassle, it's more difficult, and it's not as attractive an option. So what do we do about that? I think.
Well, in some places, another catalyst for getting on public transit is congestion, right? In the downtowns of big cities like New York here in the US, or in London there, or in Singapore, where I was at recently with Jeremy Yap. So the mayor there of London is in charge of transport for London directly. It's a department that reports to him, and it's not just over transit. It's over roadways and traffic signals and all that. And they've had congestion charging there for quite a while, which I think people understand. But there's something new called an ultra-low emission zone, which the mayor is putting into place there, or ULEZ. Tell us about that and what's happening.
Well, ULEZ is, as you suggested, it is distinct from the congestion charge zone, which came first. ULEZ, the ultra-low emission zone, is actually in its initial stages, which came into force a couple of years ago, three, four years ago, is a zone into which if your car is not compliant, or your van or your truck or whatever, if it's not compliant with the ultra-low emission zone regulation, so, you know, it has to emit a certain level of pollution, you have to pay £12.50 a day if you want to drive your vehicle into the zone. What that means is, in effect, for most of central London, and indeed even where I live, which is sort of the inner suburbs of London, for the last few years, your vehicle has had to be compliant. So in the main, it means if you have a diesel-powered vehicle, most of the older ones are not compliant. A lot of petrol cars, but a lot of petrol cars are compliant. For example, my car at the moment is about 18 years old. It's a petrol car. It's compliant with ULEZ. So it's not the case that you have to buy a new car to avoid paying £12.50 a day. Anyway, just in the last couple of months, we've had the great ULEZ extension, which means that now ULEZ doesn't just cover the inner part of London and the inner suburbs. It covers everything right out to the M25 motorway, which is the orbital highway that goes around London.
We call that a beltway around the city. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. So this has been a massive political hot potato because, and politics always comes into these things, as you well know. There's been huge opposition to the idea of pushing the ULEZ zone out to cover the whole of London. So a lot of misinformation about it, a lot of legitimate concerns as well. There will be somewhat people who do have to change their vehicles because otherwise they will be eligible to pay the £12.50 a day, which is a lot of money. But equally, TfL, Transport for London, estimates something like 9 out of 10 existing cars will already be ULEZ compliant. So it is a worry which is perhaps out of scale with the actual problem. That said, it's a very emotive thing. People feeling they're not able to drive their car where they want, when they want. And it's definitely, that has definitely affected current political debate and discourse in the UK because we had a what's called a by-election, which is where a sitting member of parliament, in this case, Boris Johnson, who used to be the prime minister, leaves their constituency. They say, I don't want to be an MP anymore. So you have to vote a new one in, but it doesn't come after, you know, in a 4-year election cycle. It comes in right in the middle of a parliament. And quite often the opposition party will win these elections because they can often be protest votes and so on. It was widely assumed that the Labour Party, the opposition party, would win the constituency called Uxbridge. In effect, by about 500 votes, Boris Johnson's party won. Now, this was something of a surprise. And part of the reason for it was that an anti-ULEZ expansion mobilisation went on. Uxbridge falls into the new expanded ULEZ zone. So there was that was able to be weaponized, if you like, as a political issue, despite the fact it wasn't necessarily that germane. But nonetheless, it was very, very powerful. And I think as a result, political parties in the UK have looked at that and said, hang on, maybe this ULEZ thing, maybe people don't want to be told that they can't drive their car. Maybe they don't like the expansion. And this is fed into a few sort of big announcements that we've had here over the last month.
Yes, I just saw that. Yeah, your prime minister made an announcement. Yeah.
Absolutely. So we've revised some net zero targets. We've revised some green targets. And we're now, you know, the prime minister has been talking about the fact there's in inverted commas, a war on motorists. And this is very, very attractive to a lot of people because loads of people drive cars and they suddenly think, wow, we're under attack. No, I don't think they are. I think, you know, this is politicizing, but it might be quite smart politicizing, but it's, I think, a good illustration of the way that if you seek to impose any restriction on the way we move around, or as we see it, our individual freedom, that does come fraught with political risk. Yeah. I think, which is also why the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has actually been quite bold. And again, whether you agree with him or not, it is undoubtedly bold to extend the ULEZ zone because it hasn't been fantastically popular. So, you know, so many things wrapped in there. And I think another thing, and Paul, sorry, I am going on. So please.
This is interesting though. Yeah.
But if one of the really interesting things, as we were saying before, how do we get people out of their cars? How do we get them to use public transit? Well, we can get them out of the cars by penalizing them, by saying, you know, if your car doesn't comply with these emissions standards, you need to pay £12.50 a day. And that will be a natural way of pushing people onto public transport. But the public transport has to exist. The connectivity has to be there for those people. Otherwise, they will either get resentful, not unreasonably, if they feel they're, being discriminated against in some way. Or I guess they just won't comply. And I think part of the reason that ULEZ expansion perhaps will succeed and will, I think, win people over is that there is a pledge by the mayor of London to use the money that is taken from it to invest in public transit around London. So in the outer suburbs where the connectivity is perhaps not as good, certainly not as good as it is in the center of London. So, but that's a really interesting idea. That's an interesting link, a direct link between you get out of your car and we are going to invest in public transport. And I think that's got to be the way forward. There's no point just penalizing people. There has to be some, they've got to see some gain. So we'll see. It's very, very early days. The expansion has only been in the last year or so. The mayor of London is up for re-election next year. We also have a general election in the UK next year. We'll see. There's a lot of politics. But I think I do guarantee that motorists are going to be very much at the center of politics in the UK for the next year, 18 months, because they're a powerful constituency. Most of us are motorists, as well as being other things. We're also cyclists, we're pedestrians, we're public transport users, we're parents. So, you know, arguments around better air quality, improved road safety, they're also very powerful as well. They're powerful arguments. People get them. So there's a lot of different factors at play, I think, certainly here. And, you know, this is a microcosm, obviously, of what's going on in many other countries. I'm very interested to see how the New York City congestion zone pans out. I'm fascinated by the idea of the motorists in the capital of the world being told when they can drive. What do you think? How's that going to go down?
Well, it's moving forward in New York City as we speak. It was passed and adopted and allowed. My understanding is, you know, they're putting up cameras, et cetera. But it is the people in New Jersey are suing New York because a lot of them are going to have to pay going in. So in the end, like most things here in the U.S., it'll probably be decided by the courts. So, but thank you, Adam. This has been a fascinating look of comparison and contrast, I think, between what's happening in public transportation here in the U.S. and there in what we call Great Britain, which I know is now the United Kingdom. But really, we talked a lot about what's happening in England, which is the basis of it. So thank you for this great talk. And if people want to read more about this type of things, they, of course, can subscribe to your magazine, ITS International. We'll have information on the show notes about how to do that. Thank you again, Adam.
Thank you, Paul. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Future of Mobility podcast, brought to you by Edison Manufacturing and Engineering. If you have a need for a trusted manufacturing partner for low volumes of highly complex products, then please visit us at edison-mfg.com or feel free to shoot me a note directly at brandon.bartnick@edison-mfg.com or visit my LinkedIn page, Brandon Bartnick. Edison specializes in build and assembly of highly complex products in annual volumes of 10 to tens of thousands, utilizing an agile and capital-light approach. If you're making an impact in the mobility space, we'd love to help. Until next time, thank you for listening to the Future of Mobility podcast.